coming up on Star Stuff. New clues into the nature of dark energy and dark matter. An ocean of water under the surface of Saturn's moon Enceladus. And it looks like scientists have finally determined the exact age of the Earth and Moon. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
Astronomers have for the first time successfully measured how fast the universe was expanding when it was just a quarter of its current age. The findings will help scientists better understand how dark energy has been impacting on the accelerating expansion of the universe, in the process giving us a better idea of our ultimate fate. The new findings come from the Baryon Oscillation Spectroscopic Survey, or BOSS for short. It's the largest component of the third Sloan Digital All-Sky Survey, an ongoing project which has pioneered the use of quasars to map density variations in intergalactic gas at great distances, showing us what the structure of the universe was like when it was just a fraction of its current age. Quasars are powerful energy jets generated by supermassive black holes as they feed. They're so extremely bright, they can be detected over 12 billion light-years away, when the universe was just a tenth of its current age. And the galaxies they originate from are usually very young and full of gas. The BOSS project is allowing astronomers to trace the overall structure of the early universe. BOSS is charting the history of the universe's expansion. It'll provide scientists with a better understanding of the very nature of dark energy, which makes up around 75% of the universe. Another 19% is made up of dark matter, and just 6% for baryonic matter. In other words, the stuff that makes up the atoms and molecules which make the stars, planets, houses, dogs, cats, people and cars that make up the universe as we understand it. BOSS is providing new measures of the large-scale structure of the universe, yielding the most precise measurements yet of the expansion since galaxies first formed. The latest quasar results are combining two separate analytical techniques. One is a new kind of analysis, led by physicist André Font-Rivière of the US Department of Energy's Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, which was published late last year. The second analysis, using a tested approach to mine far more data than ever before, has just been published by a team led by Timothy Deloubank of France's Centre du Saclay. The two analyses have established the expansion rate of the universe at 68 kilometres per second per million light-years at a redshift of 2.34 and with a level of accuracy of 2.2%. This means that if we look back to when the universe was just 3.45 billion years old, less than a quarter of its current age, a pair of galaxies separated by a million light years would be moving away from each other at a velocity of 68 kilometers per second, caused by the actual expansion of space-time itself. And that figure is accurate to between plus and minus 1.5 kilometers per second. Today, that same figure is somewhere between 72 and 73 kilometers per second. BOSS uses both galaxies and distant quasars to measure baryon acoustic oscillations, which are a signature imprint of the density waves of matter and energy, which existed 380,000 years after the Big Bang, when the first atoms formed out of the opaque plasma which existed prior to that time. This allowed photons to escape for the first time. We see that today in the cosmic microwave background radiation, a temperature of 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. These baryon acoustic oscillations are imprinted in the distribution of all matter, both dark and baryonic, across the entire universe. While dark matter remains invisible, for the moment at least, the imprint is evident in the distribution of ordinary matter, including galaxies, quasars, and intergalactic hydrogen. Berkeley's principal BOSS investigator, David Schlegel, says 3 years ago, BOSS used 14,000 quasars to make what then was the biggest 3D map of the universe to date. And 2 years ago, with 48,000 quasars, Schlegel's team first began to detect baryon acoustic oscillations in these maps. Now, with more than 150,000 quasars, Schlegel and colleagues have been able to make extremely precise measurements of these baryon acoustic oscillations. the imprint of these oscillations corresponds to a slight excess of about 5% in matter density. And the separation between these imprints, which could be viewed as waves across space-time, is known as the baryon acoustic oscillation scale. Recent experiments, including BOSS and the European Space Agency's Planck satellite, which has been studying the cosmic microwave background radiation, put the baryon acoustic oscillation scale, as measured in today's universe, very close to about 450 million light-years. And this can be used as a standard ruler for measuring the expansion of the universe. Previous work from BOSS has used over a million galaxies to help measure the baryon acoustic oscillation scale with incredible accuracy. But beyond about 6 billion light-years distant, galaxies become really faint and hard to see. So for much greater distances, like those in the present studies, BOSS has pioneered the Lyman-Alpha-Forrest method of using spectra from distant quasars to calculate the density of intergalactic hydrogen. See, as light from a distant quasar passes through an intervening hydrogen cloud, patches of greater density absorb more of that light from the distant quasar before it reaches the sensors here on Earth. The absorption lines of neutral hydrogen in the spectrum of light coming from that quasar and going through the hydrogen gas leaves a telltale signature known as Lyman-Alpha lines. With enough good quasar spectra, close enough together, the position of the gas clouds can be mapped in three dimensions. And it's from these maps of hydrogen clouds going deep back through space-time that the baryon acoustic oscillation signal can be extracted. Although only introduced by the BOSS team a few years ago, this method called autocorrelation now seems almost traditional for cosmologists and astronomers. The just-published autocorrelation results by Dlubac and his colleagues employ the spectra of almost 140,000 carefully selected BOSS quasars. Meanwhile, Front Ribera and his colleagues determine baryon acoustic oscillations using even more BOSS quasars, but in a different way. Instead of comparing spectra to other spectra, Font Ribera's team correlated quasars themselves to the spectra of other quasars in a method called cross-correlation. The quasars the astronomers targeted are from the denser parts of the universe, where the density of the intergalactic gas should be much higher. So astronomers expected to find more of the absorbing gas than average when they looked near these quasars. When they looked at the data, they found the correlation was good enough to see the baryon acoustic oscillation imprint. So Lubeck and his team combined their autocorrelation results with the cross-correlation results of Font Ribera and his team, and they converged on a narrow set of constraints which provided a baryon acoustic oscillation scale, showing that when the universe was 3.45 billion years old, less than a quarter of its current age, the expansion rate of space-time was 68 kilometers per second per million light-years. Cosmologist Dr. Brad Tucker from the Australian National University says the findings provide important clues about how dark energy has changed over time.
Measurements of dark energy and the universe as a whole, so these distances we make across the universe, were first done using these standard candles, these exploding stars called supernovae. But this different measurement are these standard rulers, and these baryonic acoustic oscillations are essentially sound waves from the early universe, or if you could think about it, sound waves from the Big Bang.
These are pressure waves that we can see in the first 380,000 years of the universe's existence after the Big Bang, and they've sort of kept expanding ever since then, is that right?
That's right. So the Big Bang wasn't an explosion, but it was an expansion. So these are the sonic boom, if you will, from when the Big Bang grew very fast in its period we believe called inflation, which is related to the BICEP 2 results not too long ago. And just as you're to drop a pebble in the pond and you get the ripples that slowly go out, and further they go out and you get the further ripples coming behind it, well, the ripples are always a set distance between.
About 120 megaparsecs, is that right?
Exactly.
And you can see these as very slight changes in the density of matter spread throughout the universe today. Is that right?
Yeah, you can. The best way to imagine is if you have a tsunami going through the ocean or a wave going through the ocean, and there's seaweed or there's muck and stuff like that in the ocean, and when the wave comes through, you get a more dense or a more clump of the seaweed along the wave, and it kind of rides the wave as you go through. And galaxies in the universe have done this with these waves from the Big Bang. So we have just a slight more clumps of waves from the Big Bang where these ripples are.
And this is about 5% more than the natural background level of matter.
That's right. And so because you're looking at such a really a small difference in how many there are, you have to find hundreds of thousands, if not millions of these galaxies in order to find enough to find where these ripples are.
And so by looking for these baryonic acoustic oscillations, how do you look for them? Firstly, this has got something to do with looking for neutral hydrogen, doesn't it?
So there's a couple different techniques. And what you want to do is find something from the galaxy that is strong. So there was an Australian experiment that did this called the Wiggle Z experiment on the Anglo-Australian telescope up at Siding Springs. And they wanted to find galaxies that were producing lots of stars because lots of stars produce hydrogen and hydrogen's really easy to find. And so the BOSS experiment did a similar thing. They're trying to find a different type of hydrogen, which is a very strong line. And you know exactly where and what color that line should be.
Now, this is the Lyman alpha line, is it?
That's right. So this is what we call the hydrogen alpha line, and it's the primary emission of hydrogen. And if you find this line, you know exactly what the color should be on Earth, and you can measure what the color is from the galaxy and calculate the difference between the two and figure out how fast it's moving away from you.
So with this measure, you can determine how far away a galaxy is by how far the Lyman alpha signature is shifted, I take it?
Yes, that's right. So it's a very useful probe in determining not only where the galaxy is, but what type of galaxy it is. And that actually gives us very big clues into how galaxies formed and also how the matter came together in the early universe.
What are the new BOSS results telling us? The expansion rate was roughly 68 kilometers per second per million light years. That could be directly compared to the Hubble constant now, couldn't it?
Yes. So there's actually a big problem in cosmology in that we can measure the velocity or how fast the universe is growing right after the cosmic microwave background. So 380,000 years, we've got that measurement from Planck. We can measure it really well today using variable stars and exploding stars. But what we want to do is measure it at different times in between.
And that's what this helps us do.
That's right. And there's a big problem right now where the measurements very early on in the universe and today don't match up. So either we don't know how to calculate speed or acceleration, or one of those measurements is wrong.
And the data we've got indicates that when the universe was a quarter of its current age, the acceleration rate, expansion rate, was about 68 kilometers per second per million light years.
That's right. And that matches up what we get roughly with the cosmic microwave background, so 380,000 years after the Big Bang, so a long, long time ago, but it's still different than what we're measuring today.
And today it's what, about 72, roughly?
72 to 73, depending on your experiment, that's right.
Hubble constant. That must be telling us something. Well, what is that, as a cosmologist, what does that tell you?
So there's a couple different options of what could be this. If the universe has changed speed at some point, then what we believe is what we call dark energy. So what's causing the universe to grow faster and faster changes with time. So it's not actually a constant value. It's something that changes with time, and that is groundbreaking. It also could be that there are extra types of particles in the universe, and these specific types of particles are called neutrinos, that we think we have found all of, but there very well might be more. And if you have more, then that changes how much mass you have, and that changes essentially how much you calculate your speed.
More than three flavors of neutrino.
That's right. So this could imply there's more than three flavors of neutrinos, or there could be something more exotic going on. If all of your values match up, then okay, well, everything's fine and, you know, we can go on our way. But if those aren't right, or if they don't all agree, and that's what this is telling us right now, then there has to be more to the universe than we're currently measuring in some form or another. And so one of the experiments we're currently working on myself is to try and redo the Hubble constant at the local universe. So this measurement that we're getting at 72 to 73 kilometers per second per million light years, to do it to the same precision as all these other measurements to make sure that we are indeed seeing something unique about our universe.
Am I right in interpreting this by saying that the measurements show that early on the universe was expanding at 68 kilometers per second per million light years? Now it's 72, 73. That shows that there is something called dark energy, which is causing the expansion of the universe to increase.
It not only shows that dark energy exists, but dark energy is not most likely the thing we call the cosmological constant, which is Einstein's prediction. It is actually a something that has a physical value. It's a physical force, a physical energy. It's not just the energy of space-time creating in the vacuum.
That's Dr. Brad Tucker, a cosmologist with the Australian National University's Mount Stromlo Observatory. Meanwhile, a new study of gamma-ray light from the centre of our galaxy is making the strongest case yet that some of this emission may be arising from dark matter, that unknown substance which makes over 70% of the material of the universe and at least 19% of the overall mass energy budget of the universe. Using data from NASA's Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, scientists at the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory Fermilab, the Harvard-Smithsonian Centre for Astrophysics, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and the University of Chicago have developed new maps showing that the galactic center of the Milky Way produces more high-energy gamma rays than can be explained by known sources, and that this excess emission is consistent with some forms of dark matter. The new maps have allowed scientists to analyze the excess gamma ray emissions and test whether more conventional explanations, such as the presence of undisclosed pulsars or cosmic ray collisions on gas clouds, could possibly account for it. However, after a careful analysis, scientists found the signal simply could not be explained by currently proposed alternatives, but it does match predictions for some very simple dark matter models. Our galactic center teems with gamma ray sources, from interacting binary systems and isolated pulsars to supernova remnants and particles colliding with interstellar gas. It's also where astronomers would expect to find the galaxy's highest density of dark matter, which only affects normal matter and radiation through its gravity. The theory is dark matter attracts normal matter, and it forms a foundation upon which visible structures, like stars and galaxies, are built. So far, no one really knows the true nature of dark matter. But something called WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles, represent a leading class of candidates. Now, theorists have envisaged a wide range of WIMP types, some of which could mutually annihilate or alternatively produce an intermediate quick decaying particle when they collide. Now, both these pathways end with the production of gamma rays, the most energetic form of light, and these gamma rays would be at energies within the detection range of Fermi's telescope. When astronomers carefully subtract all the known gamma ray sources from the Fermi telescope observations of the galactic center, there's a patch of leftover emissions which they can't explain. This excess appears most prominent at energies between 1 and 3 billion electron volts, which is roughly a billion times greater than that of visible light. The emissions also extend outwards from the galactic center for at least 5,000 light years. Scientists believe annihilations of dark matter particles at masses of between 31 and 40 billion electron volts provides a remarkable fit for the excess they're detecting based on its gamma ray spectrum, its symmetry around the galactic center, and just its overall brightness, really. Writing in a paper submitted to the journal Physical Review, the researchers say these features are difficult to reconcile with other explanations proposed so far, although they do admit there may be as yet undiscovered plausible alternatives out there somewhere. Still, dark matter with a mass range of 31 to 40 gigaelectron volts or billion electron volts can be probed by direct detection using facilities such as the Large Hadron Collider, the massive atom smasher at CERN. However, researchers caution that it'll take multiple sightings from other astronomical objects, as well as the Large Hadron Collider and some of the direct detection experiments now being conducted around the world, to validate their dark matter interpretation. While the great amount of dark matter expected at the galactic center should produce a strong signal, competition from many other gamma ray sources does complicate the case for detection. But by turning the problem on its head, scientists may have another way of attacking it. Instead of looking at the largest nearby collection of dark matter, they're now looking at places where the signal would have fewer challenges, places like dwarf galaxies orbiting the Milky Way, which lack many other types of gamma ray emitters and contain large amounts of dark matter for their size. In fact, these dwarf galaxies may well be the most dark matter-dominated sources known. Of course, there is a trade-off. Because they're much further away and contain much less total dark matter than the center of the Milky Way, dwarf galaxies would produce a much weaker signal and require many more years of observations in order to establish a secure detection. For the past 4 years now, the Fermi team have been searching dwarf galaxies for telltale hints of dark matter. The published results for these studies have set stringent limits on the mass ranges and interaction rates for many proposed weakly interactive massive particles, or WIMPs. They've even eliminated some models. In the latest results published in Physical Review, the Fermi team has reported a small and provocative gamma ray excess, raising more than a few eyebrows. However, they admit there's a 1 in 12 chance that what they're seeing in the dwarf galaxies isn't a signal of dark matter, simply a fluctuation in the gamma ray background. Now, if it's real, the signal should go stronger as Fermi acquires additional years of observations and as wide-field astronomical surveys discover new dwarf galaxies. If scientists ultimately do see a significant signal, it could be very strong confirmation of the dark matter signal claimed in our galactic center. We'll keep you informed. New data by NASA's Cassini spacecraft indicates an ocean of liquid water exists far below the frozen surface of Saturn's icy moon Enceladus. The discovery, reported in the journal Science, explains the source of the huge plumes of mineral-rich water seen spewing from long, distinctive geyser-like fractures in the moon's southern polar region known as Tiger Stripes. The study's lead author, Professor Luciano Yes from the Sapienza University in Rome, says the new data allows scientists to finally quantify the amount of water and its distribution under the surface of the 480-kilometer-wide moon. See, everybody was expecting to find liquid water under the surface of Enceladus, but what they didn't know is whether it was a huge amount in a large subsurface ocean or simply scattered in tiny pockets layered below the surface. The findings by Yes and colleagues show it's a substantial amount. In fact, it probably best equates to North America's Lake Superior, which contains about 12,000 cubic kilometers of water, making it the second largest lake on Earth. The new data shows the Enceladus Ocean is between 8 and 10 kilometers deep and located between 30 and 40 kilometers below the moon's southern polar region. The data also shows this subsurface ocean extends up to maybe about 50 degrees south latitude. But according to Yes, he can't exclude the possibility that this ocean continues beyond 50 degrees south. In fact, it may even pass the equator and go all the way up to the North Pole, in which case it would be a global subsurface ocean. The one thing the scientists can be sure of is that the thing keeping this ocean water liquid is a process called tidal heating, which occurs as Enceladus is gravitationally stretched and pulled during its orbit around Saturn. The new Cassini data also confirms that Enceladus is a differentiated body with a 200-kilometer radius low-density rocky core beneath its subsurface ocean. Earth and the Jovian moon Europa are the only other known places in the solar system where liquid water is in direct contact with rock. That's important because the presence of rock and liquid water means the possibility of a chemical soup developing with mineral nutrients infusing into the water, and that simply couldn't happen if the subsurface ocean was surrounded by ice. According to Yes, a rich chemistry is likely taking place in the Enceladus Ocean, and he says that's a far more exciting prospect than if you just had liquid water and ice with no chemical reactions, which may well be the case for the other places in the solar system where we think there's liquid water, such as Ganymede, Callisto, and Titan. Yes says the prospect of a chemical reaction between rocks and water makes Enceladus and the Jovian moon Europa very exciting and interesting places from an astrobiological point of view. Yes and colleagues were able to determine the subsurface ocean's existence using Doppler data from three Cassini flybys of the Enceladian moon. Each of the flybys brought the spacecraft within 100 kilometers of the surface. This determined the gravity field of Enceladus and allowed scientists to explore the dichotomy between the moon's northern and southern hemispheres. They measured tiny changes in the spacecraft's velocity as it flew past the moon. The changes are caused by the mass of Enceladus and its gravitational anomalies, especially at the South Pole. The authors detected a negative gravity anomaly, causing a decrease in the gravity acceleration at the South Pole, mostly caused by missing mass. The mass is missing because Enceladus isn't completely round. There's a depression at the southern polar region about a kilometre deep. And when you have missing mass, you have less gravity. However, the negative gravity anomaly wasn't as strong as it should be for the amount of mass that's missing. So, yes, and colleagues knew there must be some denser material there, and liquid water, which is about 7% denser than water ice, is the most likely explanation.
We flew twice by the South Pole and once over the North Pole, so we have been able to measure the asymmetry in the gravity field. However, there is other information which comes from gravity, which is the moment of inertia. And this allowed us to say that Enceladus is indeed a differentiated body, which is made up by a rocky core, low density, about 2.5 grams per cubic centimeter. I'm using the metric units.
Sure.
Top of this, there is about 50 kilometers of ice, and sandwiched between the ice and the rocks in the southern polar region, we find liquid water. So the total radius of Enceladus is 250 kilometers. We have 50 kilometers of ice, 200 kilometers of rocks, and in the southern polar region we have this thin layer, about 8-10 kilometers of water, about the same mass of Lake Superior.
How does the discovery make you feel? Everyone thought there must be water ice under the surface somewhere. That's what everyone thought, let's be honest. So when you saw confirmation of this in the Cassini data, how did you feel?
It was certainly an interesting finding, although for me at least not really unexpected, because I would be more surprised to find no gravity anomaly, for example, at least in terms of this compensation. So it's interesting, and the point, however, here that we have been able to quantify the amount of water that is present and also assess more or less what a likely geometry of that water reservoir could be. So this is the real novelty, because as you said, everybody was expecting to find water, liquid water, but we didn't know whether were tiny pockets in the subsurface or layers in the subsurface be a lot less in principle.
That's Dr. Luciano Yes from the Sapienza University of Rome. New computer simulations of the formation of the solar system have determined the Earth and its moon are 4.47 billion years old, some 65 million years younger than previous estimates. The sun and its solar system are known to have formed roughly 4.58 billion years ago out of a collapsing molecular gas and dust cloud, which is thought to have been triggered by the death of a nearby star in a massive supernova explosion. The shock waves from that explosion rippled through the molecular cloud, causing a slight area of increased density, leading to a runaway collapsing of the molecular cloud, eventually forming the Sun and its planetary system. As for the Earth and Moon, well, they were formed when a Mars-sized planet, which astronomers originally named Morpheus but have since renamed Theia, and which may have been a giant Trojan asteroid in the same orbit, slammed into the early proto-Earth. The collision caused both bodies to melt into a massive magma ocean, with most of the dense material forming the Earth's core and lighter materials forming its mantle and crust. Now, some of the debris from this collision was ejected into space, forming a ring around the Earth, which eventually coalesced to form the Moon. A report in the journal Nature claims the new date for the formation of Earth and Moon is based on 259 computer simulations, and they think it's accurate to within 99.9%. The new findings therefore dispute some previous estimates that the moon-forming impact occurred as early as 30 million to 40 million years after the solar system's formation. The computer simulations are based on how the solar system evolved from a primordial disk of planetary embryos swirling around the sun. The program simulates the crashes and mergers of a disk containing thousands of small planetesimals until they eventually meld into just four terrestrial planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, which of course exist today. By analyzing the growth history of these terrestrial worlds from the simulations, scientists discovered a relationship between the time the proto-Earth was impacted by a Mars-sized object to create the Earth-Moon system and the amount of material added to the Earth after the impact. Other scientists had previously demonstrated that the abundance in the Earth's mantle of highly siderophile elements, which are atomic elements that prefer to be chemically associated with iron, is directly proportional to the mass accreted by the Earth after the moon-forming impact. They found that this material accounts for just 0.5% of the Earth's total mass. Now, if the Theia impact had happened earlier in the solar system's history, there would still have been many more free-floating planetesimals out there for the Earth to sweep up, and consequently, there would have been more of this material in the Earth's mantle. On the other hand, if the impact happened later, there'd be less planetesimals and fewer material to impact with the Earth, giving a smaller percentage of total mass, which is, of course, what the geological evidence shows. The estimates also agree with some interpretations of radioactive dating measurements, but not with others. Because the new process is independent, it helps to guide scientists as to which radioactive dating measurements are the most useful for this sort of long-standing issue. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And for the latest news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science. And that's the show for now. A special thanks to ABC Radio National and the ABC Science Unit for all their help and facilities. I'm Stuart Gary, and we'll be back next week with more Star Stuff.